The crack is back, ladies and gentlemen, and my God, we nearly thought we weren't going to make it here today with technical updates to laptops and what have you, but we're here. Shout out Andy, she got it all done. We have a working computer. I'm from a different angle slightly today because I'm using a different computer. And you can see I've got a glow to me today. That's because I got sunburned while I was walking my dog. That is not important though, because this is a combat sports show. And if you didn't know, there was a big Senate hearing on Wednesday. We had Nico Ali Walsh, we had Oscar De La Hoya, we had Nick Khan, Ted Cruz, everybody weighing in on the Ali Reform Act. Now, you know that I have two of the greatest journalists in the history of combat sports on this show. But when I suggested adding someone with a bit more expertise to this conversation, well, the boys bit my hand off because it is a man that has been on this show before. You might know him from those episodes. You might know him from the Hey Not The Face Substack, which is absolutely amazing. He is an authority on all things combat sports litigation, and he'll be joining us all today. Let's bring in the four-pack. It is Chuck Mendenhall, Ben Folks, and John S. Nash. John S. Nash, my God, welcome, sir. We are very, very happy to have you here.
Sorry for the reclining pose. I got, if you can see, I don't even know if you can see, I got my cat on my lap, right? So if my hands are doing this, this is really unfortunate that my camera, I can't tilt even lower because right now this is just not going to look good, the whole show, me doing that. So, but just letting you know, I just want the audience to know that is my cat. My cat is actually right there.
Look at this amazing setup, John. Yeah. He looks so relaxed. What I know. He's got the mic that comes in like he's Howard Stern or something. There's a man
holding that mic. They're like holding it over him.
Yeah, there is. I got the boom mic operator.
Petting a cat on his lap like he's a Bond villain.
Well, I was thinking more of Don Corleone, but it's a little pathetic over here. Yeah. Don, there's, but still, I just thought your audience on the video would like to know that I am not stroking myself. There is a cat.
You're on the right show for it.
Yeah.
If you get the
It's allowed if you need to, whatever you need to do. Really.
hearing of this.
Yeah.
John, we are so happy to have you here because we need to get onto this Senate hearing. A lot of people have come away from this, and the discussion I'm seeing and the discourse kind of vibes with a lot what you've been saying before, where this is almost a foregone conclusion at this point. I mean, a lot of people feel like this is just a matter of time. Tell me what your key takeaways were from Wednesday's hearing.
Well, I think some people think it's more of a foregone conclusion than me. I've always said the odds are it's very likely that this gets passed and signed into legislation, that the bills pass both chambers, goes to Donald Trump's desk. I think that's very likely, but I don't think it's a 100% guaranteed, like some people seem to say, only because if you'll pay attention to the news, there's a lot of shit that's going on. And like this bill itself is really late. They had plans for it to be signed and in place by the beginning of this year when they rolled out Zuffa Boxing. But because of the shutdown last fall, the original hearing was delayed like 5-6 weeks. And so they ran into a lot of problems. That, when you got a war in Iran, you got the Epstein files still floating out there, you got members of the House dropping out repeatedly. It's possible still that something could happen. But based on the performance, based on how it went yesterday, you have to say that for Zuffa, they have to be feeling very confident that this will very rapidly get to a vote in the Senate and likely pass. Because as people in Congress have told me, I've spoken to members of the committees, their staff. The one thing they've noted is there is not as large of organized resistance as there are typically for bills. Usually you have any sort of labor bill, the unions show up and their connections show up, or an association or someone shows up to counter it. And here, because it's boxing, it's very disorganized, very hodgepodge. And the people that are trying to resist it, God bless them, are a very small group of people.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. And I watched Chuck's colleague Luke Thomas speak about this from Morning Combat today, where he was discussing Senators Cruz and Rosen, and them kind of having been they've been endorsed by TKO Holdings over the years, which might make it feel a bit incestuous. But to speak about the lack of organization within boxing, they did have some notable detractors of this reform act, one of which was Muhammad Ali's grandson. And just to give people a flavor of what he said, I believe we have a synopsis of comments he made in his opening 5 minutes here.
Fighters are labeled independent contractors. As a result, people say fighters will have options, that we can just go elsewhere. But when the same company controls who you fight, how you're promoted, and whether fans ever see you, it's not much of a choice. When one system controls access, choice becomes theoretical, not real. The Ali Act was built on a simple principle. The people controlling fighters should not also control the entire marketplace those fighters depend on. That separation exists to prevent conflicts of interest and exploitation. The new Muhammad Ali Boxing Revival Act would undermine that principle. By allowing one entity to operate across promotion, management, and matchmaking, it removes independence. When that happens, you fight who you're told to fight, or you don't fight at all. At that point, real choice disappears, and so does negotiation. This type of centralized system is already seen in mixed martial arts, particularly in the UFC, where a single organization controls promotion, matchmaking, and fighter contracts. In that model, fighters typically receive under 20% of the revenue, compared to boxing, where fighters can earn up to 80%. The newly proposed Revival Act pushes that centralized model onto boxing, behind the claim that boxing is broken. Boxing is not broken. If it were, UFC champions at the height of their careers would not be actively targeting boxing fights because of the fair pay. That movement is rarely seen in reverse due to the UFC's centralized pay structure. Boxing has never been perfect, but one of its strengths has always been competition. Multiple promoters competing for fighters creates leverage and fair market value. When that competition is consolidated to one system, leverage disappears. Protection should be strengthened, especially around health and safety, but not used as justification to restructure the sport in a way that removes power from fighters. If this bill is passed in its current form, it should not have my grandfather's name on it, as it would betray the principles that his act was created to protect. He fought for dignity outside the ring. This is about dignity inside it. Fighters should not have to choose between their careers and their rights.
That's Nico Ali Walsh, who I thought really conducted himself really, really well at the hearing yesterday. And I've heard a lot of complaints about Oscar De La Hoya. I was listening to Insider Boxing earlier, speaking about his involvement yesterday, and maybe we can speak about that later. But I guess, John, the question for me is, you've kind of mentioned this lack of unity among the boxing people, like creating just a wall against this Reform Act. And as we know, there are people within the boxing world that have endorsed it too. Is this more of a conversation, do you believe, for the MMA community rather than the boxing community right now?
Well, I mean, the conversation that there's a lack of unity, that part, because...
No, sorry, the conversation about the Reform Act and the boxing kind of taking into this UFC model, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, it is. No, I mean, the thing is that it is very related. People try to always make this argument that boxing and MMA are completely separate sports, completely different. But their markets are very similar. Their structures are technically very similar. It's two guys fighting in a ring or a cage presented for an audience, you know, where you sell tickets, you broadcast it, you have sponsorship, and they're fighting eventually to win a championship. The difference is what we permit in one sport and what we don't permit in the other. So for MMA, because we permit them to operate like pro wrestling, they're allowed to have their own titles. They're allowed to thus say that just fight for this title, you have to be signed to our promotional entity exclusively, where that doesn't work in boxing because the titles are separate from the promoters. And so fighters are competing to get these titles, promoters in turn are competing for the fighters, where the reverse, as Carlos Newton will say, happens in MMA, where the fighters are competing to get the promoter that'll give them access to the title. And so it's a completely different structure. So it's just the flip side of the same coin of where the problems are. Now, I thought Ollie Walsh did an amazing job there because he kind of laid it out perfectly in his opening statement, and he was the highlight for those that are opposing the bill. Mm-hmm. And it was disappointing that members of Senate maybe didn't pick up on what he said and ask questions, but I guess that goes hand in hand with only being a select few members of the Senate there. And, you know, I don't think Ted Cruz, as much as he came across as fair and balanced, he did, you know, it looked like he had he threw a softball right over the middle of the plate for Nick Khan at one point. So
the
obviously there's
situation.
The middleweight. It's like, you know, it's amazing that Nick Khan knew all the middleweights because no one does, even fans of boxing. And yeah, people spotted it, had a list on his table right there when he did it. So, and then you have Jackie Rosen, who's from Nevada, who, you know, all things said, if you're in Nevada, TKO is a massive enterprise there. You are not going to go against him. But I thought his explanation was great. And it kind of boils down what the problem is. And, you know, and it's pretty simple. The Ollie Act was put in place for multiple reasons, but namely to protect boxers' financial interest. And the way they did that is we want to create competition. Well, competition is the number one way to raise athletes' pay. I've had James Quinn. If people are not familiar with James Quinn, I've had the attorney James Quinn on my show to discuss this. James Quinn is the attorney that represented all the major stick and ball sports when they negotiated their collective bargaining agreements. He's the guy that worked with them when they came up with he was there in the NBA when Oscar Robertson filed an antitrust suit against the NBA. He was there when they came up with the idea for the NBA to possibly decertify and sue the league to get concessions instead of strike. He was there when the NFL took this strategy. So he is very familiar with the subject. And he will tell you the number one thing that drives athletes' wages is not a union. A union is there to protect the right to protect the right of free agency, so there's more competition, and then negotiate away that right to free agency for concessions. But the number one way pay goes up is competition. And if you have the structure that you have in MMA, it's specifically designed to prevent competition because you own the title. You do not have to compete with other promoters for that champion. On top of that, you engage in a practice called coercive contracts, which the Ollie Act specifically prohibited, where you say the only way you can compete to fight this fighter or compete for this title is you sign a long-term exclusive contract with me. Well, that's illegal under the Ollie Act. You cannot force people to sign long-term exclusive contracts just for the right to meet one boxer, specifically someone for a title. In fact, they have something called mandatories in boxing, where if you become the number one challenger, you get the right to compete for that title, win that title without giving away any contractual obligations in the future. And if you win that title, you get to walk away with the belt. So in some ways, that's why you see the situation in boxing where there's constant co-promotion, where there's constant movement of big name fighters moving from promotion to promotion, like Canelo Alvarez, like Devin Haney, like Shakur Stevens, all these guys moving around with their titles in place. They do not they do not have to go through a long process of years and years and multiple fights to finally get out of their contract, although that happens too. There's long-term contract, there's all those problems. But usually when you get to the very top of the sport, usually a lot of those guys, if you notice, Bud Crawford and Canelo, they're signing short contracts and they have the right to leave with the titles and rankings as they do so, so other promoters can compete for those.
John, one of the things that I remember hearing a lot early on in this process was people being kind of surprised, like, hey, where are the boxing promoters pushing back on this attempted, you know, TKO sort of takeover of boxing, especially when you have Dana White out there more or less saying, we plan to take over. We plan to, like, you know, we're beating up babies. We plan to take over this sport. And with this sort of legislative push, I saw a lot of people going, what is it with these guys? Have they not woken up to the reality of what this would mean for them? Did they not realize how close it is to actually becoming a reality? Why do you think it is that we haven't seen more boxing? Do you think that they're starting to wake up to it now? Or do you think that they have seemed kind of absent from this discussion, at least in any substantial way?
Well, I think there's a couple of things at play here. One is, we have noticed lately, I mean, the last few months, Oscar De La Hoya, who was there at the Senate, has been talking about it. Eddie Hearn has. You had Bob Arum and Top Rank have brought it up. The kind of surprisingly quiet people are the people at PBC. They've been quiet about this, and they're a major player. They haven't said anything. And so there has been some talk about it in boxing. But the other problem is I think part of it too is they are still very strongly connected to Sheikh Turki, Turki al-Sheikh. And so they do not want to upset him, right? They want to still collect those paychecks, payments, whatever that he's been doing with his Riyadh season. And but as this moves along, I think they're starting to realize that maybe this Saudi money's drying up, and also maybe this is not in their best interest. The other issue is I'm sure a lot of them underestimate TKO. I think if you listen to the comments, like a lot of promoters, they have this view that Dana White runs Zuffa Boxing, and it's just like it's another promotion that's trying to get in the space. And for a long time, they didn't quite understand, no, it's more than just another promotion, because yes, it's Zuffa Boxing with Dana White, and they put on shows like everybody else, but this is a piece of an entity called TKO that has a monopoly that runs MMA and the UFC, a $20 billion enterprise. The WWE, which is pretty close, you could make a strong argument that has monopoly of market, overwhelming market share of pro wrestling at a $20 billion valuation, staffed by elite executives that are connected to Endeavor, that has its hands in multiple entertainment industry businesses, including podcasts and communications and stuff, so get the message out, and then now tied in with the Saudis, which so any money they want to give is probably going to go to the Zuffa Boxing. So this is an entity that is much bigger, much stronger than any traditional boxing entity. And on top of that, they have strong relations to the White House. And it's the fact that this bill has been moving so rapidly, just so insanely rapidly through Congress, I think is finally woken people up. This is different than what we've seen before. And maybe some of the concerns that people have voiced from MMA that are more actually familiar with this idea of how you take over combat sports markets, maybe they're correct, and we should be concerned about what the future holds if Zuffa Boxing gets what they want.
Hey, John, you know, Oscar De La Hoya, like, I know a lot of people are talking about him, but does he, like, you watch something like this, he's got the platform, he has the chance to kind of counter and to point out the things that we're talking about. Did he do more harm than good in this situation? I felt like he was up there and rather, you know, just by basically saying that boxing's in a good place, and that it's functional and that it's healthy or whatever, like, it, that seemed to me the wrong approach here.
That was a terrible approach. The introduction to the bill by Ted Cruz is, we all admit that boxing has troubles and we're here to talk about how to fix it. He said, you know, paraphrasing. And then Oscar, boxing is perfect, there's no problems. Well, we've been laying out, everybody who's a fan, everybody that follows boxing knows, and that's been the history of boxing since its founding, you know, since it became popular. You can go back and read like 1880s, 1890s newspapers articles. Boxing's dying. Boxing's not going to last for a generation. So it's been perpetual dying. And it's had tons of problems throughout its entire history. But then here's Oscar saying everything's perfect. It was a terrible performance by him. I think one problem might have been the fact that they've created this alliance to defend the Ali Act, which is, it's great in some ways. Like, finally, a group of people in boxing are getting together to defend the Ali Act. I thought one of their smartest things they did is they put Nico Ali Walsh in the forefront, because not only can he speak well on the subject, which we proved, he has the Ali name, so he can counter Lonnie Ali, I mean, that they rolled out at the House hearing. So that was very clever of them. But then they picked Oscar, and I think the problem is twofold. One is, they, in this alliance, are the sanctioning organizations. Well, they're the problem. And you know, you can say that this, and this is my argument, this Ali Act, this they're proposing with TKO, is a terribly designed bill designed specifically to benefit them at the expense of everybody else. But that doesn't mean that boxing doesn't need some improvements, that the regulations don't need revisiting, and that the sanctioning organizations have failed in their duty. And Oscar seemed unwilling to say that. And he also seemed unwilling to basically say anything, because he wants the status quo preserved, because he's a promoter. And that's the sad part of these hearings, is if you go back to the 90s hearings, they didn't have just such a small group of people. They brought in a huge number of stakeholders to testify, as well as not even in Congress. They did written reports. So they were bringing in matchmakers. They were bringing in trainers. They were bringing in boxers. They were bringing in members of the media to discuss it, to give a wide breadth of options and opinions. And here it's a very narrow focus on those for it and those against it. And that's, I mean, it's obviously it's designed not to produce the best bill possible.
Well, we're speaking about Oscar De La Hoya, and Chuck and John have spoke about some of the criticism he got here. Here is his opening gambit. And again, we've cut it down. just so you get the best bits.
This principle change of the proposed amendment allows a promoter to create an entity that serves as both promoter and governing body, a so-called unified boxing organization. This mirrors the existing MMA model and creates a closed system controlling rankings, titles, and access to opportunity. Under this structure, as long as the UBO complies with its own internal rules, it would not violate the Muhammad Ali Boxing Reform Act. Meanwhile, traditional promoters like myself would still be required to comply with full financial disclosures. In other words, one system operates under transparency and accountability, while the UBOs do not. This is a fundamental shift in power that, if changed, would put corporate profits first, fighters second. We should be clear about who benefits from this. These changes align directly with what Zuffa Boxing and its leadership at TKO Group Holdings have already said they intend to build in boxing, a model similar to the UFC. And we already know what that model looks like, and it does not work for the fighters. The UFC and its parent company agreed to a $75 million antitrust settlement after fighters accused them of suppressing wages and restricting competition. At the same time, Zuffa Boxing is fully funded by the Saudis. We've already seen how that kind of funding reshaped another sport through LIV Golf. We should be honest about what is happening here. That was sports washing, a clear effort to use sports to reshape reputation. In current Zuffa contracts, fighters are locked into rigid earning structures with little to no ability to negotiate. The promoter controls all major revenue streams, including media rights, ticket sales, and sponsorships, while fighters are limited to guaranteed purses and discretionary bonuses, with only narrow participation in upside revenue. As an independent contractor, fighters won't have leverage when one system controls all opportunities. Under current law, fighters already have the right to see the financials behind every event they headline, giving them a fair opportunity to negotiate their compensation. I also want to address safety. The proposed changes suggest improved protections, but boxing already has strong safeguards in place and existing protections, including health insurance for injuries and life insurance for fighters' families. Commissions and promoters ensure fighters are medically cleared and covered and cover related costs. If this proposal is truly about protecting fighters, why are MMA athletes not included at all?
And there was Oscar De La Hoya. And of course, we did speak about his kind of stance where nothing's wrong with boxing, which hasn't really gone well with most people I've heard speaking about this afterwards. His opponent, I guess, John, was Nick Khan. And he is so good at speaking to these people. I feel like I was listening to this and I was disagreeing with nearly everything he said, but I was like, it just feels like it's playing so well. He's so smooth. Like he at one point, at several points, he was bringing up amateur boxing and the Olympics. And I was like, what the fuck has this got to do with this act? Like this amateur boxing, I don't know how they're making the argument that somehow this UBO being founded will somehow help boxing in 2028 at the Olympics and we can have another Oscar De La Hoya. He mentioned at one point, like, nobody in the world, like, he had the middleweight thing where he said, who is the middleweight champion? And Nick Khan had all the answers there. Ted Cruz asked him, Nick Khan had the answer. He also said at another point, like, nobody knows who the heavyweight champion of boxing is. Usyk, nobody knows who this guy is. I feel like he is speaking to the people that matter, you know, in terms of this Congress, these people in the Senate, they can't think of these things off the top of their head. But how valuable of an asset is Khan in all of this, given his legal background?
I mean, he's tremendously valuable. In fact, you know it is for the two hearings they've done in the House and the Senate, who didn't make an appearance, who was not there to argue on behalf of Zuffa Boxing, even though he's supposedly the front person of Zuffa Boxing. They had Lawrence Epstein, did a tremendous job, incredibly skilled at this, at the first House hearing. And then they have Nick Khan for the Senate hearing. So they're keeping Dana White's job is not to speak about this. In other words, when they do interviews too, do you notice when it comes to time for an important vote, who was out doing all the interviews about Zuffa Boxing at the time? It was Epstein and Nick Khan. So they're very, very important assets to have for this. They're very well spoken on it. You look at the comments Oscar said. First of all, I'll go up for Oscar's opening statement, which actually was pretty good for the most part. He did an excellent job of comparing it, like what they're trying to do to the UFC, and then laying out the problems with the UFC, the complaints that maybe the Senate wasn't aware of. And then he closed with a strong statement, like, if these protections, if this bill is so great, why doesn't it include MMA fighters? But then he had to insert a little thing in the middle, which I don't have any idea why he inserted this. I don't know who told him to put this in there, about how current medical protections are great for boxers. Because, yes, you know, you could say we have gone along, we've come a long way from where we used to be. Look what the 1996 Health and Safety Act did for the boxing. It improved it tremendously. We've gone, we are doing a much better job than we ever did in the past, but we're talking about the health and safety of fighters. We can always do more. Let's investigate and see what is more we can do. What can we accomplish more that is possible without putting out our business tons of club shows, which potentially this bill could have done if they would have left a previous provision in. So that would have been an argument, but his argument like, oh, health and safety is perfect. Well, I think that's, I mean, that just, you know, it just seems tone deaf, on the subject. Even if you were going to do a hearing about MMA, I wouldn't recommend Zuffa Boxing or, I mean, the UFC, if they're going to do an MMA hearing in the Senate, to say, oh, the health and safety standards are perfect in MMA. We could never improve them. You know, you wouldn't, that would be pointless by them. They could brag about how good a job they've done than everybody else, but you'd think they would be smart enough to say, we can always do better. Help us come up with even a better system for everybody. And I don't know why Oscar couldn't do that. He just has to defend the status quo, which is just an absurd thing for him to do. Now to Nick Khan and his statements, it was impressive what he said, but there is, you know, and this I give him credit, is no one's going to question him. No one's going to fact finding on it and see, oh, is he telling the truth or not? We do not have a pants on fire meter going with him because he brought up that there was only one champion when Marvin Hagler was champion. And that's true. Yeah. Marvin Hagler was the man, but it still was a three belt era. He was the one guy because he had unified the belts. I mean, it was also a little different at the time because the IBF had just appeared, but still the fact is he's complaining there's too many titles. And yet your example, Marvin Hagler held three titles, and that's excluding the Ring Magazine title he held. And you're talking about, we're trying to bring some sort of, unity to the sport. That's the other argument. At the same time, we're offering options, just options. Fighters can choose either system. Well, if the problem is there's too many titles and you're offering options for fighters, and you're introducing another title, aren't you just making more titles? Unless the goal is that there aren't options and this is the only title that matters. And so it's, no one's going to question that though. It's, they're just going to, everybody seems to let those things pass. And so, but he is well versed in the subject. And I think that's the big problem is Nick Khan and TKO knew they're going to introduce this bill. They knew they're going to have to appear in front of the Senate. I don't know for fact, I'm not in Zuppa's room, but I know pretty close to fact that he has probably had hours upon hours of meetings to discuss this. He has probably read hours and hours of reports and deck slides and presentations of what they're going to do. They have probably done focus groups. In fact, I'm pretty sure they've done focus groups to go over the messaging, what's the strongest message they can do. And he has that on his side. On the other side is Oscar De La Hoya, who had a good written statement, but the subject is not something he has been debating, discussing for a long time. This is something that only in the last few weeks or days, he's made the decision that he's going to go and fight. And so when they ask him specific questions, it's not ingrained into his system to come out with the right answer. He is, you know, searching for answers and falls back on the defense that everything's fine, leave it alone.
Hey,
or his clapback Thursday defenses.
John, what's your sense on when the appropriate time for WrestleMania to visit Cleveland? Would you prefer it in 2029 or 30?
Can you believe that Ohio got rid of Sherrod Brown for what they got now? They let the cryptocurrency guys fucking spend an outrageous amount of money to get him out of office so we could have guys that blatantly ask for, you know,
I love how
open bribe.
He kept going back to it too. Like at first you're like, all right, that's funny. And then he goes back to it like three times.
I think it would be amusing if Oscar did say, Mr. Moreno, are you saying that your vote is dependent on if they bring WrestleMania to Ohio? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, I am.
Because that would at least maybe got some attention in the news about that. And that's one thing that's kind of interesting, maybe sad, is that this story, and combat sports as a whole, has not been picked up by the greater news media world at all, because, you know, it has all these elements you would think that would draw interest from mostly the left of center, but not all of them are left of center, but the labor news media groups, the antitrust groups, all these subjects, corporate cronyism, all these things are kind of tied into this subject right now as we're seeing it. And there's no one has seemed to pick up on that outside of the combat sports bubble. And so we're getting no attention from, you know, the pundits that seem to follow this. And on top of that, even on the Democrat side, on the Republican side, I guess we're a long ways from John McCain, who was an actual fan that actually tried to do something. Because if there were any more John McCains, you think they would dust off the bills McCain introduced to fix the problem that never got voted on and were partly blocked by lobbying by Zufa, that were supposed to address these issues of the OLLI Act not being as effective as it was. But on the Democrat side, who've argued for a while, oh, we've got to become this more populist, pro-labor, anti-corporate, anti-monopoly party, is that you think it'd be ingrained in their nature just to suddenly start raising questions, and yet they do not. They seem to give a pass to a company that has the brother of Rahm Emanuel running it.
John, sorry, go ahead.
My question is, I guess I've been one of those people who's been a little fatalistic about any attempt to oppose this, just because it seems like, especially right now in American government, when the big companies with a whole lot of money who also happen to be close personal friends with the president want something, they get it. And so you mentioned early in the show that you thought there were more, it wasn't just necessarily a given that this would go through, that there's a lot going on. You know, that's obviously true. What do you think could reasonably stop it? What would that actually look like? Do you think it's just that distraction of what else is happening in American governments would be the thing that just stops us from bringing it to a vote and getting it to Trump's desk? Like, what would make this not just sail right through?
Well, I think that'd be the major thing, was something big pops up that just derails all votes in the House, in the Congress, that they have bigger priority. I mean, they already have bigger priorities than this, obviously, but something so big that they, you know, they have to, all their attention goes to that, and this just is thrown to the curb. That's number one. That's possible. I mean, it's kind of unlikely, but it's possible, especially in this climate, that might happen. I think the biggest hurdles you're going to face is, one thing is interesting, is Ted Cruz said that he's going to introduce a new version of the bill, which surprised me, because I thought for sure he would introduce an identical version as the one that came out of the House. And the reason I thought he didn't introduce an identical one, because if it passed with no changes, then the bill could go straight to the desk of Donald Trump to sign. Now, because it's going to be slightly different, if it passes the Senate, they have to reconcile the two bills. So they have to go back to the chambers to find out what they're going to do to get, you know, about the differences they have in the bill. And that would give an opportunity, because remember, Democrats said they were not satisfied with the bill. They're hoping to get another stab at it. Well, that would give them a chance to get another stab at it, create more problems. And the longer the process takes, the more likely something pops up that derails it, the more likely, you know, I mean, there is a possible, if something comes in to derail long enough, what happens if we get to the end of this session of Congress and it doesn't get passed because something got in the way and has to be reintroduced? Well, you think it immediately get voted on, but then what happens if the Democrats run both houses, right? Both chambers, I should say, the House and the Senate. Well, then the bill might die, because it's not a priority for the Democrats. It's a priority for the Republicans, because someone from the White House called them and said, this is a priority. Let's push this bill through. So I think that's the best chance, is that the process gets dragged out, which can happen, and it gets dragged out long enough that something else interjects into the process to extend it even further, to the point where it's after the elections. And now it's too late, because if we go into next year, a new Senate and House of Representatives takes their seats, and they might be Democrat control, and they're not going to be interested in pushing this bill through.
Well, John,
but that's unlikely. I should note that's unlikely.
Once again, we're so grateful to have you on here. You are unbelievable on this kind of terrain. We look forward to everything you're going to put up on Hey Not the Face, Substack. We love the podcast. Hopefully we'll even get something on Uncrown, because I know you've done some writing for us, which has been very well received too. Thank you so much for joining us today, John. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me and the cat on.
I'm glad. I hope you're relieved that they found Dana's phone too. Thanks, man.
Oh, yeah. I was very relieved. Yes, about that. People aren't aware on last week, this last thing before you guys kick me off the show, because I'm sure people are tired of the subject. But in the antitrust suit that's going on, people are not aware that is Oscar La Hoya and Nicolai Walsh brought it up. The UFC is being sued again for class act, for antitrust violations and a potential class action. And part of the process is discovery. The UFC was ordered by the court to preserve all evidence and then hand it over to the defendants to examine for potential information. And so the UFC, since 2014, has been under an order to preserve all their cell phone communications. And just a long list of problems they've had on the UFC, the defendant side, is that they've lost phones, that they accidentally deleted or set phones to delete, that they did not alert the court that Endeavor executives were using the Signal app, which came out during the Vince McMahon lawsuit with the UFC-WWE merger. On that discovery, they found out that Ari Emanuel and Mark Shapiro had the Signal app and had been deleting their messages and didn't report that. Just a long list of stuff. And one problem, too, is Dana White was missing a phone on top of having accidentally deleted, apparently, a bunch of material. And his missing phone, they thought that Ari Emanuel's nephew had stolen. And so that was the reason. But
the intern.
Yes, the intern. And now, but they go, oh, that was a mistake. He didn't steal it. We have now found the phone. It was in the back of an old BMW Dana White had used a couple BMWs ago. But because it was in a black leather case on black leather seats, we couldn't find it. And now we found it. And the question is, I don't think they have the password for it, so they can't open it. So they're handing it to the forensic expert, and he will see if there's anything on that phone.
You know, I know how that is. One of my daughters left a chicken strip in the little back, the seat, like little pocket behind the seat. That thing been there. That was two summers ago. So it can happen.
It can happen. I mean, all I could think of was Homer Simpson when he was asking for the speaker to yell at Bart, and then he had the only thing he could ask him was, where is the remote? And it was in his back pocket. And that's what I like. All I could think of was that moment. Like, why, you know, it feels like that.
Well, John, you're the man, John. Thank you once again. We really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have you back on to spit some game in our ear about this current reform act or proposed reform act.
Anytime you guys want. Anytime you want, anytime I can do it. And anytime that works, I guess, there's like, we don't want to have your people contact my people.
I absolutely will. Thank you again, John. What a guy. Right, lads. I mean, it's just the three of us now. It's a bit weird. And look, Ben's in a bad mood because seconds before the show today, I sent him a message to say that the Saudis have pulled the support from the opera, the Metropolitan Opera, Benioke, first of all, because we knew the Saudis have been pulling money and the opera is something close to your heart.
I just wanted to, can I get a list of the things that the Saudis don't financially support?
It's very short, the list.
It feels like that would be a lot quick. It honestly starts to make me feel a little bit like, how come the co-main event podcast that I co-host has never been approached by Saudis? Like, how come, you know, we're over here at the University of Montana cutting our, English master's program. Like, the Saudis just couldn't dip in the pocketbook just a little bit. Like, they're funding everything else in America. What the hell's going on?
It's a good point. I mean, it is interesting, though, right? This Saudi cutting all this money. Well, this is going on.
And the figures, wasn't it like $200 million or something like that?
$200 million, yeah.
I mean, and it's not like it's insubstantial, you know? It's like that's a big number.
It is. Like, I mean, it's billions they're obviously investing. Formula One, LIV Golf, we saw that collapse. And obviously, Saudis are a partner with TKO and this boxing venture. Interestingly, I saw an interview with Eddie Hearn. He tends to do them quite a bit. He was speaking about Devin Haney, and he was kind of saying, look, we don't have the money to pay this guy. He is not interested in, you know, traditional boxing bouts as we used to do with them. He wants the big ones. And next of all, a report is out that they're talking about doing Haney and Shakur Stevenson on a Zuffa promotion on Netflix. And it's like, how is this, with all this money being pulled and they're saying we can't invest in this, it's kind of feeling like, are you guys making money back on this boxing venture? Because I don't think it is actually possible that they could be making money off this. I just wonder why this seems to be their last stand, combat sports. You know what I mean? Am I missing something?
I think in part because that's his enthusiasm, right? Like, he likes boxing. I mean, I swear, I think it's just that simple sometimes, that it's an area of interest more than the others, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that honestly is shockingly plausible, like that if it comes down to it, somebody looks at the books and says, we got to trim some of the fat here. What do you want to lose? And they go, we are spending an awful lot of money on boxing. And he goes, but I actually really enjoy that. And they go, yeah. What about the Metropolitan Opera? And he goes, okay, that one.
He's like, take that one.
Golf gone. Golf wasn't much as golf.
The went to see something at the Met was not nearly as fun as I thought it was going to be. Boxing. He's that off, was yeah. a lot more fun.
Just get rid of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe you'll have an investment in RAF soon, because Ben Foulkes wrote a big old article about RAF. Chael Sonnen, and $1 million investment and a prospect by the name of Bo Bassett, I believe. And really, great article, by the way, and great quotes from Chael and Bo. But really, the thing that's jumping out to me from this article, Ben, is obviously we know RAF has rose to prominence by using a lot of the fighters from the UFC roster, namely Armin Sarukian, who's become pretty much the poster boy of this situation. A lot of people believe that TKO, UFC are allowing these fighters to work with RAF to kind of stand alongside their arguments on the class action suits that John was just discussing. They've recently announced that Khamzat Chimaev has joined the roster. Armin Sarukian appeared on Ariel's show on Wednesday and said, you know, they're getting money commensurate to what they're getting for UFC fights and RAF. You have this prospect, Bo Bassett, who you spoke to. He's sounds like an extremely talented guy. You've listed off the opponents he's beat. There has always been a conversation about, after college, after the Olympics, what do you do as a wrestler? Is this becoming a viable option, do you think, for wrestlers to continue their careers beyond those Olympic and collegiate dreams?
Well, I mean, for a guy like Bo Bassett, it was a viable option before even entering college. He's obviously a rare case, but I do think there's something happening with RAF where, if you've been around in this combat sports zone for a while, you've seen a few different people try to launch some sort of real wrestling promotion, and almost never does it work for any length of time. Like it's never worked. It's never been a going concern. It's always been just sort of here and gone. It's difficult to get people who aren't already super into wrestling, because it's a highly technical sport. You got to know a lot about it to begin with to even sort of enjoy what you're seeing for the most part. The rules, the scoring criteria, all that is not especially fan friendly if you're not already in it. And RAF has found a level of success that we haven't seen anybody else get to. One of the ways they've done it is like they do, if you watch the broadcast, they do have a pretty fan-friendly approach to it. It's a good-looking broadcast. They move quickly from one match to the next. And they're roping in such an interesting cast of characters that we've heard of. And so they're kind of following a similar model that BKFC has done, where they go, hey, we'll get some of these interesting people into interesting matchups where you go, I do wonder how that would play out. Let me go over there. And they have the advantage, the complete opposite of BKFC, is that they can go to somebody like Armin Sarukian, or they can go to somebody like Uriah Faber and be like, hey, man, it's a wrestling match. It's kind of low stakes, low risk. I mean, at least if you stay on the mat and you don't run your opponent onto the concrete on purpose. You the risk of you getting hurt in, you know, three periods of wrestling is pretty low, especially if you know what you're doing. Maybe you win, maybe you lose, but you don't take too much of a hit. You don't get your face all beat up. You don't take brain trauma or anything, and you can make some decent money. Now, I don't know what kind of money they're making back. They have a deal with Fox Nation. That's where you got to sign up for an account to go watch it and everything. So they have pretty good crowds. It feels like a real event. I don't know if they're turning a profit. I would say almost likely they are not turning a profit paying these guys that kind of money this early on in the thing. But then that's probably the case for BKFC still too. I do think that one of the things, it was interesting talking to Chael about it, because you see him on these broadcasts and you could tell Chael really loves wrestling and has loved it since he was a kid coming up in wrestling, all through high school, you know, went to college, went to BYU just to wrestle, was not at all interested in the religious aspect of BYU. The way he put it to me one day was that, yeah, they'd come and talk to you about it, but he said, I'm a Catholic, and I'm a Catholic on purpose. They're not going to convince me of anything. And BYU cut their wrestling program, and Chael said he was looking for places to transfer the next day, transferred to University of Oregon back home, and went back there and wrestled. And he still has this love for wrestling, very evident how excited he is on these broadcasts, but also he's been around it long enough that he referred to it as a road to nowhere. And he was talking about somebody he knew where he's like, I know this guy he's a state champ in high school. No college programs were interested in him. There aren't that many big time college programs left. Basically you could go to somewhere where it's a club sport, essentially not even an NCAA sport, but none of the big time programs were interested. And so it was just like, hey, congratulations on your state high school wrestling championship. It's over. No, your wrestling career is over. You're 17, 18, and it's just over. And he's like, you know, that is still the reality in wrestling. And I go back and forth between hoping that it could, RAF or something could give you an opportunity to do it beyond that. But he said everybody eventually leaves that sport with a broken heart and a bad back. And as much as he was excited about Bo Bassett, felt, you know, his offer, he explained, he was like, I was basically offering, I'll give you $1 million to sign you to an NIL deal because I think I'll be able to turn around and sell you as a marketable commodity other places in a way that will bring me more than $1 million. And I'm going to keep everything I make back, but I guarantee you the $1 million, and just wasn't able to pull it off. But it also, it just seems like the market is still so small. The question is, can you either grow that audience base for wrestling? Or you would have to get better at getting absolutely every single human being who is at all interested in wrestling to watch this, or you just have to get better at monetizing it somehow. Like right now, I don't know if we have seen yet whether this is going to work, but I will say it is working better than anything we've ever seen anybody else try up to now.
You know, Uriah Faber said he had a bad back, but that out of bounds thing actually fixed his back.
You can't convince me Armin's not doing that stuff on purpose, man. Like,
he's just misunderstood, Ben. He's just misunderstood, okay?
He drives him like 50 feet off the...
Yeah, like, and especially, yeah. And did it at a point in the match where the match was essentially over. You were going to win. You didn't have to do all that. You're doing too much. But yet, there's no way, like, if you're RAF, you've got to be pretty happy with the investment, the return on investment you're getting from Armin Tsarukyan. Because if you're paying him that much to come and wrestle for you, he's wrestling for you like every month. Mm. And every single time, pretty much, he does it, he does something that makes people go, all right, what is this guy's deal? He does something where the video circulates on social media. It drifts around all over the place online and people are reminded that this thing exists and that some interesting stuff is happening there. And so he's doing you a huge favor by doing stuff that creates these viral moments. It's just also kind of a dick move to other people because he's doing it at somebody else's expense pretty much every time.
I mean, he's a godsend. It's almost like he's probably more popular. I wrote about this at one point. Like, he's probably more popular right now with RAF than he was as a UFC fighter. If you just strictly divide them, which is a crazy thing because you like what you just said. Nobody pays attention to it otherwise. You know, it's very difficult if you're trying to, like you mentioned BKFC, like a lot of times it's like, let's take these MMA brand names and put them in our ring and see what they do. People will peek in on that, but it's tough to get an MMA, you know, a person who watches MMA to pay attention to something more specific. We're used to a wider range of things that you're watching within a fight, a more danger zones, all that stuff. So to go to wrestling specifically, like, you know, real wrestling, it is, you know, it's like going from like an action movie that you've watched for, you know, into like some kind of weird think piece that you're like, we're not used to watching this kind of thing. It's been the way they've navigated that. I mean, Armin plays a huge role in it, but the way they've navigated that has been very good. I would say that it is one of the more positive things. You remember like Metamoris and some of the jiu-jitsu. Yeah. They would start those up, and I thought that might have the effect. They tried. They pumped money into it. They were paying their competitors fairly well, but it just didn't have any traction. But I feel like this right now has traction, and they've kept the kind of overhead lower by just, you know, going to college hotbeds, you know, college wrestling hotbeds and smaller venues and, you know, affordable production. I know they're probably not turning a profit yet, but given the exposure that it's gotten, I bet the trade-off right now is still worth it, right? Because people are paying attention to it.
Yeah, it's. I feel like the way they've used Armin, they're nearly in that situation that the UFC were in with Chuck Liddell, when everyone was like, yeah, well, what are they going to do when this guy goes away? And of course, the UFC did a great job, obviously on a smaller scale, they aren't quite there. Like, I mean, they're not on the cover of magazines, big magazines, Sports Illustrated, all that kind of stuff. But I would be interested to see if they can get a draw akin to Armin. So it's just not so heavily on his shoulders right now. Certainly for the casual audience, I'd say it absolutely is. Casual audience in mind, big fight coming up at the White House. Don't know if you guys heard about it.
Hmm.
White House is where your president lives, I believe. The UFC.
Part of the time.
Yeah. The UFC, big fighting company. They're doing an event there. There's lots of talk about the structure, building, and blah, blah, blah. One thing we do know is Alex Pereira is going to fight on that card. Mm-hmm. Chuck Mendenhall has wrote an article this very week about the GOAT status that he could somehow capture should he win against Cyril Gane. And it's a very well done article because, Chuck, you've broken down everything. Like all of the candidates there, your GSPs, your John Jones, your Anderson Silvas, even Khabib Nurmagomedov makes an appearance. I mean, when you lay it out, right? When I was reading the thing at the start, I was kind of like, come on, it's an interim title fight. But when you lay it out, the fact that this guy has defended the middleweight title, the fact that he has defended the light heavyweight title, has won back the light heavyweight title after losing it to Ankalaev, where do you stand? Are you beginning to convince yourself with those beautiful words you put down on paper?
Well, it was Michael Chiesa who actually said this first, right? That was like, it got me to thinking, and I was like, I should actually look at this, because he said if Pereira goes and wins a third division title, that he's the GOAT. And at first I'm like, that's ridiculous. That's not true. We've seen him lose, but then you start thinking about it. I'm like, okay, wait a minute. What's the criteria of determining this? Like, how do you defend it if you really believe that? Like, how would you defend the guys against him who haven't done that? For instance, Khabib, I brought him into it because he barely lost a round during his career, you know, and like that has to be considered through this process. But ultimately, when I was doing this, I was like, no, not really. Because what you start to think about is the circumstances surrounding each step, you know, he wins. And I mean, still to this day, the biggest accomplishment was him beating Izzy in that first time, right? And like kind of pounding home the past story and saying like, hey, check it out, I can beat him in MMA too. Now I've got his title. But then he loses it. And I thought that, you know, it, kind of order was restored and he goes to 205 pounds more out of like, you know what, I don't want to make the weight cut and I don't really want I'm just going to go and try this other. I don't really think that we were all looking at him as like he's going to challenge immediately for a title, but he ends up doing that. His run there is very good, but circumstantially, we've talked about the heavyweight mess that's been going on for so long, the belts, the interims and everything, and people like stepping aside and vacating and everything that's gone on. For him to fight Cyril Gane, who has already lost to a series of the great names in the division, even if it is an interim third title, like it's a third title, I would probably need to see him win that and then unify that before I would have that real discussion with Alex Pereira. I mean, yeah. I'd love to hear you guys' thoughts on this, because that's, to me, I'm like, okay, I guess you could start to put him in that picture, but that's what he would have to do, I think, for me to be like, okay, now there's serious consideration for this.
Yeah, I think that it's the kind of thing that if you beat Cyril Gane, you add another version of another UFC title in another weight class. And certainly it's a great accomplishment. It looks good on paper, but as you know, the GOAT conversation is always at least a little bit of a vibes conversation.
Yes, it is.
You know, it's never just about like the accomplishment. We're going on like how we see you, how we perceive you. And if you go in there and you beat Cyril Gane, who at this point kind of has developed a reputation of the UFC are going to keep giving him title shots when no one else is available or willing, you know? And so it's like, it's still meaningful to beat Cyril Gane at heavyweight, still impressive to keep going up in weight, to start out at middleweight and end up at heavyweight, knocking people out. And it would be a huge stage to do it on. Alex Pereira seems like one of those guys where the more people get a chance to see him, the more people go, this guy seems interesting. What's he going to do next? So like, it is a good opportunity for him to gain a lot of fan base stuff. But for those of us in the hardcore MMA world, having those GOAT conversations, you do need to beat somebody like a Tom Aspinall or even a John Jones would have done it, I think, because that was why that was such a huge missed opportunity for the UFC. Because if you could have made that fight, if you could have made Alex Pereira versus John Jones, we would have all gotten so excited about that matchup that we, for the moment, ignored the fact that the real heavyweight champion is at home letting his eyes heal. And instead, you put Ciryl Gane in there and we go, first of all, it seems like the guy who gouged the dude's eyes is being rewarded for it in a way. But also that no one was looking at Ciryl Gane as this is the best heavyweight in the world at the time that you booked this fight. So I think it would take at least one more.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it, Chuck, because I found myself having an internal debate as I was reading it. You know what I mean? I've always been a GSP guy. You know.
Well, that's always been my default is like with GSP. But then you kind of break down and, you know, we're talking about kind of opportunities or circumstances in which you kind of make good on something. Obviously, coming back from 2013 to 2017, he comes back after 4 years and he fights the one guy who's like, yeah, you know what? I could go in there and beat Michael Bisping. You know, dude's got one eye and I, you know, he's like, he's not like, he's like what, at the time he was something like 38. I don't even know. So, I mean, even him, like you can start to be like, well, how do you discount these things? How do you properly discount these things? Like even Habib, you're like, well, he's 29-0, but just kind of look at his conquest list and you're like, that's not as good as some of these other guys. And then you get John Jones, who it's like, it should be an obvious answer, but he's popped hot for, I mean, some people that's an automatic exclusion, right? Like they don't even entertain John Jones just given that he's been busted for steroids, right? Like I and then, you know, that kind of puts Anderson Silva into a weird spot there too. So It really depends on how you want to kind of score it in the end. Like you said, it is a vibes conversation because you could make the argument for all these guys. You could also argue yourself out of all of these guys.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned the GSP Michael Bisping fight about, you know, GSP definitely seizing that moment to be like, now I am interested in middleweight.
I know.
When I see who the champion is.
After all those years, yeah.
Yes. There was Michael Bisping once told me when I wrote a story and he was talking about that fight and how, you know, he had been successfully fooling people about how bad his eye was for a while by that point, but that he thought GSP and his camp had a sense that there's some blind spots for Michael Bisping. And he said that when they did the thing, you know, they're at Madison Square Garden for that fight and they exchanged corners so that, you know, your corner can come into my locker room, watch them wrap my hands to make sure I'm not, you know, putting any plaster or anything in there. There's nothing nefarious. that time-honored tradition is sort of like exchanging seconds so that they can make sure everything is on the level. And he said, as I was sitting there getting my hands wrapped, and GSP had Freddie Roach as his corner man, and he said, Freddie was standing there, and he's not looking at all at them wrapping my hands. He's staring at the side of my face. And he starts kind of moving further to the side as if he's trying to see, where does this guy's field of vision lose me? Like, where does it end? And he was like, shit. Like, they're on to me a little bit. And he said he was very uncomfortable by how Freddie's just looking at him and like sort of just like, he's like, they know that my vision is not as good as I've been pretending it is. And then sure enough, GFC kind of gets on that side and clips him.
Left hook, yeah. Really, yeah. Incredible. That's an incredible tidbit there.
By the way, has he ever like taken out his eye thing for you? Like, because one time I was sitting with Michael Bisping in Houston, I was doing like an interview with him and I don't think he'd ever done this. And he's like, he just pops out the eye thing. And I was like, oh my God. It was wild. And then I'm like, okay, wait a minute. You got to tell me then, how did you convince the commissions, you know, like to basically fight? You know, like to fight under them. And he's like, never you mind, you know, and he's like, he got kind of
a magician doesn't reveal his tricks, you know.
I think he got into it in his documentaries, and he had some kind of code with one of his coaches who would somehow give him answers. He'd be in the room as a doctor was asked some things and your man would be feeding him the information.
Maybe he did it.
The whole thing more than any other stories we've heard just completely gives the lie to the idea that these pre-fight medical examinations are there to make sure that everybody is fit and ready to fight. They don't want to find anything. Everybody has a vested interest in making sure that these fights go on as scheduled. The medical exams are essentially a cover-your-ass tool so that you can say we did it in case something terrible happens to somebody. You can be like, well, we did our due diligence to try to make sure that they were good. And it also makes it so that if they try to come back afterwards and say, hey, I was fighting hurt, I had an injury into this fight, than at times, and they have done this. They've done it to MMA fighters, and they did it to Jake LaMotta, you know, 80 years ago. They'll turn back and say, you put down on this medical form that you were fine. So you lied to us. And like, it's, if anything, it's the fighter who's the only one who stands to get in trouble from that.
It's also been like the ultimate retort from the guys who think that Tom Aspinall has elaborately choreographed this injury. Like, well, but Michael Bisping fought with one eye. You're like, don't, that's not recommended.
You know, I mean,
like,
it's that, a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Who was like, yes, because this man crazily fought with one eye, what are you complaining about, Aspinall? Absolute insanity. Love the sport, of course. And, you know, boys, big old card this weekend, and we're back
at
the world's favorite venue. It is the Meta Apex. It's not the Apex. It's the, they paid good money for it to be called the Meta Apex. It's the Meta Apex.
I think Meta just laid off a bunch of people. I just saw a headline or something. So enjoy that name while it's still there, you know.
I hope we got that cash up front for the naming rights on that.
Fun. Zuckerberg popping up at UFC events makes me cringe to the point that I want to disappear with my own arsehole. I'm not going to, you know, he has created, he has created those gifts for us all through the years, the passing of the things. I mean, I just, I don't know, it gives me the willies, as they say.
Yeah.
Anyone excited for this card this weekend?
Who's on it? But,
Aljamain Sterling is on it,
Aljo. Joke.
Yes.
See, somebody was asking me about this in my mailbag, where they're asking, you know, Aljo's here in the main event, and they're just like, okay, you know, he's coming off that win over Brian Ortega. Is there enough time left? Can he make a run at 145? And my answer was no. That's the short answer. And not because, like, he's not a good fighter. Like, clearly, he can still do a lot of the stuff that he does. He still can beat a lot of those 145ers. He also, though, he's, I believe, 36. Body has been through the ringer, in, you know, from wrestling to MMA. He's got some physical damage that he's working around and through. But also, I honestly think still the biggest impediment to him having a real run and making a run at a 145 title is just going to be how the UFC sees him. They have never really liked him. They've never been eager to give him anything. He would imagine how many wins he'd have to reel off at 145, or how many other people would have to be unavailable before they reach down and be like, okay, Aljamain, especially if they thought he might win. They did not seem to love it when he was bantamweight champion. They kind of rushed him into that Sean O'Malley fight before he really wanted to. They didn't seem eager to do anything with him there. He went to featherweight in part because of that, to get a fresh start. It's hard to see, like, what would he have to do, especially they put him in this fight, which I think he's absolutely got a chance to win this one, but you can just look at the ages of each guy in it and know what the UFC is likely thinking here, right?
Well, then luckily for us, the UFC is about the best fighting the best. So all he needs to do is keep climbing the rankings, and he'd be given a deserved opportunity.
He's right, Ben.
As they will in boxing,
He's right.
That's why you're at the Meta Apex this weekend.
You know who's also at the Meta Apex?
The proving grounds known as the Meta Apex.
Mrs. Apex herself, Norma Dumont, will be appearing.
Your
on
favorite.
That card.
You know, Chuck was at the fame.
I was.
Dumont v. Ladd.
I was there.
At what point do we start referring to the Meta Apex as the house that Norma built?
I like that a lot better.
I tell you what, it's fucking depressing watching these events at 5 o'clock in the morning in Blanchardstown. Not a whisper outside, and you're like, why have I done this again? I made a deal with myself a long time ago that I won't do
this.
There's
not a whisper outside or inside. I mean, it's
like, just, at least when they're in a big arena in Winnipeg, you can draw some energy from the crowd. Yeah. And
I start like the Ultimate Warrior. I'm just shaking my fucking hands. It's some good fights in it. Davy Grant, my boy. I mean, Davy Grant, the most underappreciated UK fighter of all time, still doing the fucking thing.
Was he trying to be a shepherd as well, or is he doing something else?
No, just always on the MMA thing. You know what? He was on Tough Smashes, I think, back in the
day. Was he really?
And he's still fighting.
This was long
he had a 3-year layoff because of a knee injury, and he still goes on these runs, and they keep on putting him against these young guys who are like, oh, Davy Grant, what age is this dude? I'm going to fuck Davy Grant up. And then they eat a load of fucking elbows most of the time anyway. So I am looking forward to that. But lads, not a congested combat sports weekend, but I'm sure, you know, you'll think of things to do. Chuck, I couldn't help but see the result of the game last night. You know, first Ariel's team suffered one, and then I saw your boys, the Nuggets, and I looked at the stat line. My boy Jokic is still fucking wrecking people out there. 15 rebounds, what, 30-odd points? Come on, what's going on?
But it was a bad performance. Like, he went out and shot the first, like, five shots. They were all off. Making Rudy Gobert look like a hero in this series right now, that's just disgusting, man. That was
Chuck,
a bad
at what
one.
Point, at what point do you pivot to being like, I'm just a Colorado Avalanche guy? Because they're looking pretty
I'm already
good.
In
I don't
that
know.
Process. I mean, I always am. I am a Colorado Avalanche. I love that team, too. They are looking good. But you know the problem is? It's the team that they would face next. The Minnesota Wild have beat them a couple of times in the playoffs, and the Dallas Stars absolutely own them in the playoffs. That's where I'm like, yeah, we could beat the Kings, but I'm not sure what happens when we get to the second round. That's going to be the true hurdle, I think, for them.
I mean, they are the favorites.
Yeah,
I
they believe. Are.
They're a top betting favorite to win the Stanley Cup this year. And
they are.
See, this is me trying to get you. I know that maybe you've dabbled a little bit trying to look up some hockey, trying to find how you can watch a hockey broadcast
it's on real
from
ice?
Over there.
Wow.
Yeah. But I got to tell you, watching the NHL playoffs is a completely different experience than watching a regular season NHL game. These guys are out there every night trying to take each other's damn heads off.
Okay.
It's crazy. The hitting goes up to another level. Seemingly after every whistle, every minor stoppage in play, we're punching each other in the face. The shit you can get away with doing to another human being during the NHL playoffs without even being sat down for a couple minutes in the penalty box is amazing. And what's really insane to me is if you pay attention to what is required of the NHL referees.
I saw you posted
during
yes.
the playoffs. It's there's no way they're getting paid enough to do this, because almost every single time they blow the whistle to stop the play, they got to get between a couple. It's like 500 pounds of professional hockey player on either side of them, and they got to throw their body in there, wrench these guys apart. There are fists flying that they're catching strays. All kinds of just crazy shit is happening. Really. It's basically you ever tried to break up a dog fight?
Yes.
Your dog ever get in? They're basically doing that, you know, 16 to 20 times a night. It's insane. All of which is to say, highly recommend the NHL playoffs as a viewing experience.
Which game? Which game should I watch this weekend?
Any of them, Pete.
Yeah, absolutely. Really.
No, pick. Tell me which one, and I'll find a way.
The Minnesota Stars series is good.
Yeah, Buffalo and Boston is a good one. Buffalo is an exciting one just because they have been shit for a long time.
Did they win last night?
They did win last night.
Oh, nice.
2-1 in that series. Boston not going to go down easily, though. And the other one, for as long as it lasts, watching Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, natural enemies. And the intensity of those games has been really, really high, even if they haven't always been quite as competitive as maybe I would have liked.
The last one I watched was America and Canada, and I text you guys like halfway through going, these guys aren't fighting yet. And they're like, oh, they're not going to fight.
and the playoffs, too, generally speaking.
In the Olympics,
it's
frowned upon.
And Elaine was beside me, and she was like, what's happening? And I was like, I have no idea. Nothing. I can't explain anything. I know what a goal is. Other than that, fucking nothing.
They try to fight less, right, Ben? In the playoffs, they try to because they don't want to be suspended or, like, you know, you don't want to get into a situation.
Or hurt.
Or hurt.
The broadcast won't cut it, though, right? Like, they will show me
who
is throwing them.
They will. The referees make a much, much more concerted effort to stop the fighting before. Because that's why it's such a hard job for the referees in the playoffs, is that they are trying to break up all these scrums before it escalates into guys throwing off the gloves and fighting. And sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. Normally when they fight in the playoffs is when the game is pretty much decided. But what's incredible about the NHL playoffs is that normally during the season, you play a team once and then you move on, you play somebody else the next night. You might play them twice in a row, but that's kind of uncommon. And in the playoffs, you play a 7-game series. First person to win 4 of these games. And that is a long time to be lining up against the same guys each night. It's a plenty of opportunity for resentments to build.
Big time.
And it also makes it so that part of the intense hitting of the game is because, hey, look, we might lose game 2, but this series still got a ways to go. So if we can reduce somebody's physical output by putting the body on him in game 2, you know, if we can just...
Middle.
if we can make them start worrying a little bit more about the violence coming their way in game two, maybe it pays off in game five or six. And so, like, it's just the game completely changes in the playoffs because of the way these series work.
And you know the players inside and out by that point. The greatest thing is you see, like, a seven-game series goes to overtime. There's all this tension. It's a crazy sport that way. And then they line up in a big line at the end, and they all shake hands like gentlemen. That's a beautiful thing about
that sport. They shake hands like gentlemen, except some of the exchanges every once in a while. And, you know, when the series is over is when they'll shake hands. And sometimes you can see in the handshake lineup, there's a little bit of, I'm going to fucking kill you next year. you should retire in the offseason, because if you come back next year, I'm going to fucking kill you.
The Avalanche Red Wings used to have a bad, I mean, it was crazy. Yeah. They'd fight, the goalie would fight, everything. But that's the kind of handshake line you would see with those guys. It was fun.
I'll be tuning in for it all, the handshakes and everything. Yeah. And you know what? I'm sure Elaine is going to be ecstatic to say, oh, another American sport where you just stay up all night and then
on at the most inconvenient times.
And then when I have a phone call at 2 p.m., you're like, trying to sleep here. Well, lads, that was a beautiful education. So much education today from John S. Nash. Check him out. Hang out the Face Substack. He does a great podcast with Steffi. It's really, really good. He is the guy. He is the authority on all things combat.
I felt like he could have kept talking for another 2 hours, man. That's his wheelhouse, isn't it?
He's so good. He's so fucking good. And he has been for so, so long. There's nowhere else to go. Class action. This Reform Act, he is the man to speak to. And if there is any big developments, we will have him on again. But before we go, is there any super chats, Andy? Nothing today?
Wow.
We don't even get to hear the music today.
I mean, do you know what, Andy?
This community has let us out. I didn't. What? Oh, at least we got the music.
Yeah. Yeah, still nothing.
Buzzkill. Well,
thanks, guys. Love you very much. Thank you to Oscar Loza. Thank you to Andy. Stepping in for Jordan, who's on vacation for how long now? I mean, fucking hell. Thank you to Chuck Bethanol. Thank you to Ben, folks. I don't know if I thanked Oscar Loza already. However, I love you all. We will see you next week. I'll watch ice hockey, and we'll talk about it then. Lots of love.